AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 53 for Thursday, April 29th, 2010. The word for today is transition. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. It is Thursday night. We're back at AutoLine After Hours. Man, do we have a lot to talk about tonight. But as I always start, I have to welcome the auto extremist into the house. Mr. DeLorenzo is here.
John, glad to be here.
Glad to be here. And the first thing I want to get to when we start to get to it after the introductions is your rant this week about GM and Campbell Ewald. But that also segues me into welcoming David Welch here.
Thanks, John.
Of Business Week, although we're not sure is it...
It's Bloomberg.
Bloomberg Business Week.
That's the official name now, yeah.
And you just did a big story on Ed Whitaker at GM. It just broke literally, what, 2 hours ago or an hour and a half ago the story broke. So
cover story in the print magazine, but it's on the web right now.
Right. And then you're also going to have to talk to our guest here, Nina Beckhart from the Naming Group, an expert in naming things and branding, because we were talking before about, yeah, should it be Bloomberg Business Week? And my whole opinion was no. The brand is Business Week. Don't mess with that.
That is hotly debated in the commentariat.
Yeah. Well, Nina, thanks for joining us here on After Hours.
Thanks
great
for
having
me.
So you're in town to learn or meet and get more business and how to name cars and all that?
All of the above. So just learning a lot more firsthand about the industry, getting to know a lot of different key people, and I'm loving it. It's great. It's an exciting time to be here because there's so much going on, particularly things that touch on what I do, advertising, marketing, branding, they're all interrelated. So,
well, we'll have a lot to talk about. But as I said, I got to start off, Peter, because we saw historical. I mean, we've seen so much change at General Motors, but nobody, I don't think any company, forget about car companies, has had the same ad agency since 1919. And GM just axed Campbell Ewald. I should say Chevrolet axed Campbell Ewald. What do you make all this? And by the way, we have to tell the audience, you used to work there.
Yes, I did a 9.5-year stint there. And I still have, it's one of my ad alma maters. They lost a chunk of Chevrolet last year at the end of the year, and the writing was on the wall. They insisted that, oh, well, that's not the case, but I knew they were going to lose the rest. And it's a huge blow. This ad community has been hammered.
Over in the Detroit area.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of an inside baseball thing here, but our ad community has just been leveled. BBDO was taken out. We've lost all kinds of jobs, and this is a huge blow. But it was inevitable. IPG, the holding company that owns Campbell Ewald, they're inept. That's putting it charitably. And they needed to make changes from the top down at Campbell Ewald to reinvent the agency, and they didn't. And when GM went into bankruptcy, you know, they're all looking at their watches and say, well, what can we do? What's the easiest thing we can possibly do to signify that it's not business as usual? And that's, you know, an ad agency usually gets in the sight, gun sights. And this was, it could have been avoided, but the way things played out, it became inevitable. It's too bad because it's a lot of good people are going to lose their jobs, and they will not, those jobs will not come back in this town. Not for the ad biz.
Do you think Publicis, which got the account now, is going to turn Chevrolet around from a sales standpoint? Because, I mean, that's what amazes me in this business, and it's not just in this town, in this business. Whenever sales are no good, they kill the ad agency.
Well, the classic adage in the business is when sales are great, boy, we're making some damn good products. When sales are bad, God, our agency sucks. Our advertising sucks. I don't necessarily think it's going to work because as the second part of my column was about the fact that GM marketing needs to be blowed up real good and they need to start over. And until they do that, they're going to keep repeating the same mistakes. So they can change Campbell Ewald and plug in Publicis, but that's not going to fix what's ailing GM.
Yeah, you've been in the business. I mean, how much does the agency really, I mean, they obviously do the execution and creative work, but the client has final say. The client gives direction. Talk about that a little bit, about how that really...
Well, sometimes greatness happens. Like, think about Campbell Ewald's famous campaign, See the USA in Your Chevrolet, which is long before your times, but that was a classic.
Dinosaur in the late 1950s, yeah. Early 60s, singing that.
Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet, which at the time was just perfect. And, of course, Heartbeat of America, which was, at that time, perfect classic song. It just resonated across the country. Great visuals with it. And then the last one they did that I thought was worthwhile was Like a Rock with the Bob Seger music for Truck. The agency says American Revolution should go up with those, and it's not even in the same, not even in the same solar system.
Sure didn't work from a sales standpoint.
No. Sometimes great advertising pulls products and companies up by the lapels and makes them succeed. But if you don't have a great product, I don't care how great the advertising is. There is one incidence in automotive history when a mediocre product was elevated to myth. And that was Hal Reiney when he launched Saturn. Saturn was a mediocre product with dent-proof body panels and an engine that rivaled the dulcet tones of a Briggs & Stratton going down the road. I mean, this thing was mediocre. But by the time Hal Reiney and company was through, it was like it was a different company, and it was a different aura, and it was just amazing. But that was the last time that happened in this business.
So GM's got to blow up marketing real good. How would you blow it up? What would you do with it?
They need to bring in a player, a CMO, head of marketing, where the buck stops there, because they need to bring in a bunch of new people, and you can't do that without changing the leadership and signifying to the outside world that this is not GM marketing as usual. So they're going to have to bring in someone from the outside, and that someone's going to have to do a hell of a lot of recruiting in a short amount of time, and they're going to have to just change everything, change the way they look at it, change the way they do things. And it's not easy.
When you say from the outside, obviously from outside GM, outside the industry too?
It depends. I mean, the last time they tried that they went on that P&G jihad and the brand marketing thing, and they brought in a bunch of people who they took it to the extreme, and they brought in a bunch of people who were ill qualified, and that was a train wreck. Now they need real pros, real experienced people who have done it before, and just start over.
I feel like the external communication is important, but then also internally too.
Yeah.
You know, it's signifying that the top is new, it's going to be different, this is the way it's going to be from here on out, and then that kind of trickles down to all the employees. So you change a company from the inside out.
The problem and that's a good point, because the problem is GM has been rearranging the deck chairs, reassigning the same people in marketing, rotating them through, and you're not going to change what needs to be changed doing that.
And everyone that comes in has to put their fingerprints all over the brand image, new taglines. I mean, Saturn's gone, but Saturn was probably the worst one in terms of changing ad lines. Chevy's done it too, and now Cadillac doesn't really have stability in its ad message. It has some, but in terms of, kind of the performance imagery, but what is the tagline for Cadillac? I asked someone at Cadillac that recently, and they didn't really have an answer for me.
Well, I suggested a couple of years ago bring back the standard of the world and live up to it. Drive the organization to that tagline. And you might not achieve it in everything, but you'd send a message to the consumer public that, and it's like we were talking about the BMW. I mean, they'd have to hammer it for 10 years, 20 years, but that's what you do. That's how you build brands and name recognition. And Nina and I were talking, before the show about what a train wreck this Joy business is for BMW. I mean, here is a company that ploddingly over 20 years seeded this ultimate driving machine in the consumer public's mind, and then all of a sudden they throw out Joy, and it's just like, what? I mean, you know.
You can advertise any brand and almost any product with Joy.
Anything.
That's anything.
And the ultimate driving machine sets the bar for taglines. That is a textbook classic example. It's brilliant. It's just perfect. And there are few brands that can carry that off, and they could, and they did. And so then to bring in this Joy business, I mean, you said it. It could be diapers. It could be gum. It could be anything.
Dishwashing. It is liquid, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. Well, Mercedes did the same thing. They walked away from engineered like no other car in the world, which I think is still one of the greatest automotive taglines in history. And they walked away from it, and because they wanted to become more approachable. That's bullshit. I mean, it just is. It's just, and you know, they've been slowly wending their way back to engineered like no other car in the world. But, you know, they're too much pride. They just don't want to throw it back up there. But, you know, they should, because their vehicles, when they're on, can live up to that tag.
Right.
And that's why I believe Cadillac should, you know, put the stake in the ground and say, we're the standard of the world. We once were. We're going to be that again. Everything we do from here on out. I mean, you send a message. And if you're consistent, you deliver. Eventually, people will buy it.
I agree. But you got to be consistent. And it's going to take a decade or two to get
there. Oh, yeah.
So you've got to really commit.
And, you know, of course, in this car business, it's just like everyone's looking at their watches. It's just like, you know, it's just, you know, no one takes a long view anymore, especially after bankruptcy. It's just like we got 30 days, we got 90 days, we got 120 days, whatever.
Speaking of not long term, David, the guy that you just did your cover story on, Ed Whitaker, the CEO, chairman of General Motors. I can't.
There's the Ed theme song. There's
our Ed Whitaker theme song that Peter came up with. So what's your take? I mean, what's your story about?
Well, basically, the guy's ripped up the place, right? I mean, he's made a lot of moves. He threw out the CEO. He's replaced the CFO. Gursky is the vice chairman. Steve Gursky, the former Wall Street analyst and private equity guy. And so basically, he's replaced three of the top four executives in the company. And then you've had a lot of movement underneath that, some with insiders being moved into different positions, moved in and out of positions.
Mark Royce.
Yeah, Mark Royce, which I think we all agree with was a great move.
And then you had, it was, sure, but you know, then Royce reorganized Ed Whitaker's restructuring of sales and marketing after 3 or 4 months. So you have all of this movement, different people running the brands again. If they're going to get any stability, and sales and marketing is really where they have the biggest problem. I mean, they've got a CFO in from Microsoft. You know, the guy's very credible. They should be fine in finance. The product's good, so they don't need to rip that up. Sales and marketing is their biggest problem. That's where they've had the most turnover for the past decade. That's where they have the turnover now. They haven't been able to get a big-name outsider to come in, so they've got to go with the people they have. And, you know, Whitaker, he can't, you know, pick every ad. He's trying to drive credibility. He's trying to create a bit of a sense of urgency, a little bit of anxiety and fear so that people are accountable for it. But he's got a couple of problems. He's got a young team, you know, and he's got people new to their jobs, and they've got to sort of learn. It's on-the-job training for a company that's trying to turn it around. And you've also got, mixed brand messages that they need to get their hands on. And he needs people to be creative, but people are afraid for their jobs. I mean, there's a letter I got a hold of that he sent out to the entire staff globally on March 31st saying, you know, the big moves in management changes are behind us. And I've talked to people all over the mid-level and lower level of the company. None of them believe it. And one of the reasons they don't believe it is because, you know, on November 10th, he told my colleague Jeff Green at Bloomberg that Fritz is working hard. He has the backing of the board. And 21 days later, he's out. And so they don't buy that. So you've got this level of anxiety within the company just when you need everyone to really buckle down. And a memo from the CEO is not going to do it.
Another thing that people aren't buying is this ad that he came out with, an announcement last week that, hey, we paid off all the money.
Horribly ill-advised.
And he comes out in the ad and says, hey, you know, people didn't like the fact that we took government money. I respect that. That's what he says in the ad. I respect that, and that's why we've paid it back. And nobody believes that. They didn't pay it back. They
returned money that was given to them.
Right. And they had money in escrow, said, okay.
Well, yeah, but I'll defend them a little bit on that. The ad I don't think was a good idea. But basically what happened, I talked to somebody yesterday who was one of the top guys in the auto task force. They gave GM $49.5 billion coming out of bankruptcy because, remember, this is back in June, July when they're planning this. No one knows what's going to happen with the economy. There's talk of a double dip. You know, no one knows if people are going to buy GM's cars for a while, how deep their sales could go down, even if the economy is getting better because of the stigma of bankruptcy and bailout and all that. So they gave them enough money to last in a worst-case scenario. So here we are, in April, and it's clear that they gave more money than they need because the economy has shown some improvement and GM has some hot cars. So GM did the smart thing, which is pay the money back. Okay, you're taking money that basically was given to you in exchange for equity that the government has, their 61% stake, and you're paying off the debt portion of it. It's a good thing to do, get the debt off the books, cut interest payments. But I think all they had to do was have their press conference in Fairfax, Kansas, and the other one in Washington, and then stop.
Yeah. Don't do
it. But here's the other thing that they didn't do that they should have done is said, look, everybody, we know there's another $50 billion that we owe you, and we're working on it, and we're going to get that money back to you.
I don't think they should have even said that.
But that's being filled in the blogosphere and on all the talk shows right now.
Right now, there's a backlash to this thing. I mean, you got Senator Grassley shooting his mouth off about it. You have the blogosphere. You have analysts saying, well, all they did was pay back government money with government money. And if they hadn't made a big deal about it in the ad, I don't think there'd be as big a backlash. I mean, you have to have a press conference on this because you have to announce.
Sure, you should do all that. Yeah,
no problem. I don't have a problem with that. And I don't have a problem with the fact that they paid it off with TARP money. I mean, you got the cash.
That doesn't bother me either. It shows that they are turning around.
I had a CMO.
And by the way, the reason that they are able to pay it off is because their business has stabilized to the point, and their cash flow has stabilized to the point where they're not going to need all this other money. Their market share is actually up, albeit 0.2 of a point, but and that's without the four brands that are dead. So, the four remaining brands are doing pretty well. The new products are doing pretty well. Their incentives are down, so they may turn a profit this year. That's all good news, and that all says that, okay, we're not going to need all this extra cash government gave us. We can pay it off. That's good. But they should have just stopped there. The other thing in the ad that Whitaker, the first thing that you just pointed out that he said was that, a lot of people didn't agree with giving General Motors a second chance. Why would you remind people of that? Just when the acreage...
Because he's trying to be credible. He's trying to acknowledge, we understand that you don't like that we're called government motors. But if you're going to go that far, you got to bring up the other $50 billion and not pretend like it's all taken care of. Because that's the message they tried to leave the American public with. Or at the very least, that's how the American public now perceives GM's trying to pull the wool over their eyes.
That's why they need an image czar who is over advertising, marketing, and public relations, and that decision that commercial doesn't see the light of day.
Look, they've got not only some of their new cars really hot, but, when they had a third shift for large SUVs at Arlington, that tells you that even some of the older stuff, Yukons and Tahoes, are selling. Mark Roy said on a conference call that day that Whitaker was down in Kansas that, they're basically running at 100% capacity, some plants above, some below, but because sales are going pretty well. So that tells me that the acrid stench of bankruptcy and government bailout was starting to waft away, and some other people were giving their cars a look on their merits. Run with that. Don't get up there and say, yeah, I know you didn't want to bail us out. Because it brings it back in, and you tout it on TV like that. And, Whitaker himself isn't bad on camera. He does okay. He's not Iacocca, but, he appears okay in the ass. But the message, I don't know why they'd bring that up again. And then he gets into the cars, which was the right thing to do. You should just skip that first, 15 seconds or so of the ad and talk about the automobiles.
I mean, I'm kind of with Peter because it's just all about making sure that your base message is strong. Right now they're going through what I would call a brandzition, where...
A brandzition?
A brandzition.
I've never heard that.
Coined word of the day.
Yeah, baby, that's a good one. I like it.
So basically they have to figure out what's working and what's not working. They got to preserve what's working. They have to see where they want to go in the future and then build that bridge in between. It seems very simple, but it feels like they're skipping too many steps. Mm. I agree with you where you want to be honest. You want to not open up any holes where people could say, but you still owe 50 some odd, you know, you don't want to do that. You want to come clean, and, you know, I agree with you also that you want to say it in a press release, but if you are to do it in an ad, then make sure that you're honest and upfront. Because if you're trying to transition your way into a new kind of image, people are always going to think back to that commercial where they were being misled. This is a big mark on the brand, and not in a good way.
Big part of brand building is building trust.
And if you're spending that kind of money, talk about the products.
Right.
You've got great products. You right. don't squander that money.
My whole thing is, look, I can't buy a GM car. Don't waste any advertising on General Motors. Yeah. It's spend every single penny to convince somebody to buy a specific car or a specific brand, but not General Motors.
They canceled last summer's Buick campaign, Take a Look at Me Now, because Lutz thought they didn't talk enough about the cars. And the new one, New Class of World Class, pretty decent campaign, really focuses in on the cars and all the ads, and the LaCrosse is doing really well. It's a great car.
It's a great car.
I'm not saying it's all the ads. You know, the car itself is very good, but it is outselling the old LaCrosse so heavily,
right?
That you got to say that, you know,
that's one of the industry hits,
right?
You know? And it's a Buick, which is, you know, if someone came in and told us that the LaCrosse was kind of an also ran, the old one was, and Buick was such a moribund name that if someone came in a year ago and told us that, you know, Buick would have a hit right now, we'd say maybe, you know. And that's probably the nicest thing we'd say, and it's a legit hit. So, you know, run with that kind of campaign, and that is where they're headed. Cadillac's going to do it, too. They're going to start focusing on the vehicles themselves.
And then we have to contrast this, too, with the other news, Ford coming out with its earnings. Of course, a lot of earnings came out this week, all pretty good. I would say, you know, Honda was good, Mercedes was good, even Toyota posted a profit. Ford, though, was, like, really impressive. But I think it's the sign that the industry has turned the corner. I don't mean that it's completely recovered, but when you start looking at automaker after automaker after automaker reporting, not significant profits, but solid profits, it's, I think, a really good sign.
Well, if they can make money, I mean, this market may be coming back from where it was last year, but it still is not a historically good market at all. So if they can make some good money in this kind of market, they should be minting money.
They will.
In a couple of years.
The economy continues.
And GM will, too.
And GM will, too. GM's, I figure, financially about a year behind Ford in terms of really starting to hit it. And we'll see where Chrysler is in that regard, too. But, yeah, they've all lowered their break-even point so much that when the volume starts to come back, they're going to be money machines.
Well, I mean, there's a point I make in the cover story that they probably won't like over at the Tubes, which is that, you know, they showed the fourth quarter numbers weren't even that bad for GM's profit once you take out all those one-timers. And they may show, they're going to show even better results for the first quarter when they announce it next month. I gave credit to Lutz for those cars, and Fritz Henderson did the restructuring of the company. He took it through bankruptcy. And, you know, there's some credit that should go to those guys, one who was fired and the other who was sort of, you know, turned into an advisor and essentially eased out of the company.
Right.
But Fritz is consulting now.
Right.
To GM.
Yeah, pretty minimal. I'm sure they said, hey, do you got, you know, so-and-so's phone number? I can't find it here. Well, that's the kind of consulting they're, you know, got him doing it.
What I was told is that Tim Lee, who runs Asia Pacific, he wanted Fritz to come on as an advisor. Because, I mean, he's a manufacturing guy. He's, what I understand, pretty good. Now he's over there running Asia Pacific. Fritz ran it for a while, not that long ago, and really understands it. So they wanted to say that, and that's primarily what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk car names. This is why we have Nina here with us today. So tell us, so, what about car names?
Recently, it is just looking at the car names that start with V, there's this weird kind of copycat thing. There's the
Venza.
The Venza,
the Versa.
The Venga, and the Versa. That is ridiculous, if you ask me. You know, it's the Nissan Versa, speaking for versatility, and then there's the Toyota Venza, which, I'm going to do a little poll. What does Venza mean to you?
I have. It means nothing to me.
Okay.
Venza.
Okay, that's fine.
Maybe Italian conquest, sort of, but not really.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Venetian blinds.
All right. This is
still
like
Italian.
Rapid fire stream of consciousness. What do you think?
It's a new lingerie brand. I don't know.
Okay. Ike, any thoughts?
Fredericks of Hollywood's upscale brand.
Venza.
So what the name comes from is Adventure and Monza, the famous Italian racetrack.
Oh, boy, that's insulting now.
Yeah, that right. is a stretch, if I have ever
that's
heard of
just,
a stretch.
Yeah, when I see a Toyota station wagon, I think of racing.
I think of Monza, one of the most lauded historic racetracks in history. No, wrong.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what your response kind of gets at is that if they didn't explain it at all, it would be better. You know, to keep their mouth shut on trying to justify or rationalize, they would open themselves up to not the same kind of ridicule that mm-hmm. they're going. I mean, it's just, it seems so silly. So there's the Venza and then Versa and then Venga is the Kia, which has kind of activity, motion. Venga in Spanish is come, let's go.
Yeah. Come here.
Yeah, exactly. So that's been interesting.
So what's a sports version going to be called? The Fanga?
Peter, were you ever involved in car naming in your career?
Yeah, they would occasionally humor the agency and ask us for suggestions. Of course, they would get them over at GM. They would see us from the agency. Oh, this is nice. And jump it into the trash.
So, Nina, what makes for a good name? I mean, there's these made-up names like you just brought up here. Mm-hmm. There's classic names after animals, Jaguar, Mustang, and that sort of thing. And then there's this combination of letters and numbers, which when BMW and Mercedes started that years ago, it always had some sort of logic to it, i.e. if you saw, you know,
the engine size,
it would be the body style, this A class, B class, C class, and the engine displacement. Yeah. Now it's just like whatever. They just throw numbers and letters together that they think sound cool. What really works or doesn't it matter?
Well, and that whole whatever factor is these other brands kind of riding on the coattails. Acura has this new SUV for the driver. It's kind of this
ZDX.
And it's a cool looking car. It's really cool. In fact, I live in New York City, walking down the street, and I see one pass by, and I said, oh yeah, that's that new Acura. But I just couldn't think of the name because it just, it
sounds. Too many letters.
And it sounds like the MKX. It sounds like the MKS. It's. So clearly, as you can see, I'm just not a big fan of letters and numbers. It doesn't resonate with me. It doesn't resonate with a lot of people. It's not memorable. The name is the time, is your platform to say something about your brand, about what you stand for. I envision brands as people, basically. And every time you come out with a name of a product, you're saying something about that person. So you're projecting something. It's organic. It's living. So, I mean, to make an emotional connection with the consumer is really what you want to do. You want to inspire something. When somebody gets in that car, you want to make them feel a certain way.
But everyone's gone, in luxury anyway, to alphanumerics or just alphas. And it's almost like you don't have credibility if you don't have an alphanumeric name in luxury.
So naming serves a very important purpose, but it doesn't matter what the name is if your product can't, you know, deliver. So while that's trendy now for a lot of people to have letters and numbers, somebody's going to have to break out of that mold sooner or later because it's just going to blow up in people's faces. There's, you know, fighting about who owns the Q and who owns all these letters, and it's just, it's silly. But when a company has a strong enough product on that level to kind of come out and use a name that wouldn't be using numbers or letters, it's going to start going somewhere else. And I think that's what we have to wait for.
That's perfect, because before the show, Peter and I were talking about, and he's going to drive, as he told me, a Q. And I thought, oh, Infiniti Q45. And it was like, no, it's
the Audi Q5.
You're right.
There's so many great names on the shelf. I'm all for names. The Germans can have that space, you know.
Look, they always had it. You know, it's organic to BMW and Mercedes to have.
But there's some great names sitting on the shelf, like Continental and for Lincoln. And, you know, hey, you know, the Fleetwood was still, you know.
You know, cool. It's a great name that Chrysler had on that concept that Lutz did years ago. Atlantic is a great name.
Yeah, that is a good name. I agree. And that was a cool car.
I'd buy an Atlantic just because the name is so good.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think it has to come back. And I think Nina's right. The pendulum's going to switch back eventually. Someone's going to say, you know what? We're not going to call it the ZX9G. We're going to call it something else.
But isn't part of it, too, that they want to take these cars all around the world? And if you have a few letters, it can work just about anywhere. Whereas if you say, I don't want to use the word Mustang because it's so well ingrained historically in people's minds, but you know, that might have a problem in Chinese or whatever.
Well, there's that. There's the linguistics portion, which is very important. Any brand name that we create at the naming group undergoes stringent trademark and linguistic analysis. So the last thing you would want to have happen is have your car name mean, you know, tiny genitalia, which the Pinto... That's what it means.
That's what it meant, right.
So
in some languages, right.
Exactly. You want to be sure of all that.
My favorite is still the Mitsubishi Pajero.
Yes.
Which in certain Latin American countries means masturbator.
Right.
So
and there's,
you got to be very careful.
And it's funny, whenever somebody brings up the La Crosse, which you brought up earlier, there's a portion of Canada where...
Quebec?
Yeah, where it also, that means masturbation. So, but... To answer your question, basically, I feel as though the linguistics is one part of it. But on the other hand, when you have letters and numbers in the name and just that, there's kind of this feeling like it's much more technical. It's much more about engineering. It's not so amorphous and emotional. And I think a lot of people resonate with that, that are into more performance, more serious vehicles like that. So I think that's a reason why people lean towards that. There's an emphasis on this is calculated. We didn't bother with naming it because the engineers have designed this product according to these numbers. So that's another reason for it. But for me, at least, I don't remember those kind of things. I want a car name that will get my wheels turning, if you will.
Caliente.
What are the best and worst car names right now?
Right now.
Pajero, worst.
Venza's bad.
Venza we don't like, right?
Venza's bad.
And there's these weird foreign names, like, I think it was maybe Nissan had the Life Dunk. One of these cars.
Dunk?
Life Dunk was a car name. And that's an example of somebody in another country not doing their due diligence on kind of names that...
Well, the Japanese have always gone for weird names, English names, because, you know, we all knew the 240Z through the 260, the 280, the 300. But in Japan, it's known as the Fair Lady.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I just don't associate a manly sports car with the name Fair Lady.
Right.
And then Mazda had the Bongo Van, and Mazda even had a, they have multiple brand outlets. One's called
Bongo
the
Van.
The Bongo
Van. That sounds like Cheech and Chong's ride.
I know.
I like that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind.
And the Scrum is another Mazda brand line. So, I mean, the Japanese go for weird stuff, but they use the English. And to them, English is now so many more Japanese people speak English than I'm talking like 30, 40 years ago. But English was like exotic. Mm-hmm. And they'd use names that we would just go, what the hell are they thinking?
I think the worst one in the market right now is the Lexus Hybrid, the HS250H.
Right.
Starts and ends with H.
Right. Named by the Department of Redundancy Department.
It's just a soup. I mean, it's like some brand manager's kid was eating alphabets and, you know.
Bookended it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the Kia Soul is a really good name.
I think that's a great name.
It sure is, too.
Especially for the market that they're trying to reach. It's fun. It's funky. It's just...
Plus, it's a play on the name of the Korean capital. So, I mean,
the
Korean car,
Yeah, but
like
that's asking a lot of the current people to stick, wait, what's the cap? They don't even know what the capital of Montana is.
Do you?
Well, let's see. Should we go to the States? Helena?
It's not. Let's go people say Billings.
No.
Helena.
Let's go down the States.
No, let's not. We'll be here all week, not just all night.
Montpelier, Vermont. Mm-hmm.
Vermont, right.
Albany, New York. See, I'm telling you, it's addictive.
Washington.
Washington State?
Yeah.
Washington.
Very good, Chip.
Very
right, good. Good job, Chip.
Chip called in from...
Good man. And this is the show that DiLorenzo trashed with his state capital.
What are some of your favorite car names?
Well, I like names that conjure up what the car is supposed to be. So, you know, I've used Mustang several times in this. But it's interesting in that its direct competitor, the Camaro, is one of the original made-up names. It means nothing. I mean, mm-hmm. Somebody just came up.
My oldest sister worked at Camel Ewald in the research department, and they researched that name way back when.
But I mean, it's a made-up name.
Yes.
Camaro.
Well, it's kind of French-esque. Mm-hmm. They were going after.
Well, especially if you pronounce it like Bob Lutz does. He always calls it the Camaro.
Yeah, I know. Bob, you know. Bob can be a bit of a fop at some time, you know, at times. But I think he revels in that, too.
I like Cutlass. Cutlass is
really good until they put it on everything they built.
Wow, right.
Calais, the Sierra. Yeah.
Right. Corvette. I like the Corvette.
Corvette's a great name.
But let's go back to Camaro a minute, because made-up name doesn't mean anything. But because it went on a great car that now has got this history to it, we accept it. It's no problem. We don't think anything twice about that. It's this name that actually, when it came out, was a bit controversial because it was made up.
Right, right. And then that kind of sets the tone for other names that are created. Like, the phonetics of that name are great. Camaro, and it's very easy to pronounce. It kind of reminds me of the Panamera a little bit. There's these lilting sounds, and it just has rhythm to it, which is good for a car name. Very different than the one-syllable names like Soul, for instance. So I agree with you that it's the product that cemented that name that's going to kind of make that an iconic name.
Rolls-Royce has all the cool names. Phantoms,
mm-hmm.
Silver Cloud. But so do you guys have some PhD in linguistics who kind of sort of sits around all day and...
So there's in order to be a namer, it's a lot of different things. It is a crazy love of words, of puns, of coining words. And it's also just, you know, the psychology of advertising, marketing, and branding and how they all interrelate. What I enjoy most about what I do is just getting into the mind of the consumer, getting into the mind of the different people that are going to be experiencing the product. So you use every part of your brain, I guess. It's a big mix.
So have you seen that there's that Seinfeld stand-up routine where he's talking about the Japanese car names? I can't remember it all, but he goes off on stuff like Integra and Accord and all of these sort of things. Not just Honda names, but it's pretty good. He rips on them pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what works well? You like the lilting, like Panamera. You like that. What about ones that just end abruptly with a consonant? Does that work, too?
Well, there's a different kind of meaning for each of the sounds. So when you have an S or a Z, it's considered a sibilant sound, which connotes speed. Even the brand name Nissan, it's short. It has precision to it. It doesn't have wide open vowel sounds.
Even though we like Datsun better.
We do like Datsun, yes. And Datsun is good, too, because I know it's D-A-T, but when you hear it orally, A-U-R-A-L-L, it registers as Datsun. And on the mark, kind of, it has a precise feeling to it also.
I always liked it. Also because it was me, like the rising sun, you know, it was mm-hmm. Datsun. It was really mm-hmm. cool.
I never thought of that. Yeah, you're right.
I was at the New York Auto Show and talked with one of the PR reps from Volkswagen for quite some time. Probably my least favorite car names come from Volkswagen.
Oh, absolutely. Consistently. Touareg. What?
Tiguan.
They had to build an ad where they poked fun at themselves for how difficult the names were to pronounce. And I'm all for that kind of approachable, you know, it's hard to pronounce our names, kind of honest messaging, but why'd you name it that in the first place?
They're all supposed to be, they're all named after some kind of wind, right?
Right.
Typically.
So the Gulf and the Jetta are for sure.
Passat
also.
Scirocco,
mm-hmm. Right. But Touareg and Tiguan, no.
Well, the Touaregs were the nomadic guides.
Nomadic tribes, yeah. Slave owners in Northern Africa.
Yeah, tortured people.
Right. Exactly. And their story isn't that, you know, shiny clean. So it's not the best brand name to have. But Tiguan, they said, came from tiger and iguana.
Right.
Oh, good.
But it actually makes me think of guano, fat droppings. So I don't know. I feel like they can kind of get away with it in some way, and they're German, and it just kind of works, and it's funky and different, but
that's just annoying, okay?
It's annoying.
They're just annoying. Their attitude about it's annoying. Everything about it's just annoying.
Well, and then where does the CC come from? Just drops in.
Oh, yeah, they just drop that in. Well, no, I don't know.
What's the EOS? What's an EOS?
EOS.
Yeah. Phaeton,
I thought, was a good name.
Phaeton is actually, if you go back early in automobile history,
20s.
Was it?
Even before the 20s, Phaeton was a dual cowl Phaeton.
Yeah.
Was a very common body style. Mm-hmm. But that was then, and most Americans look at Phaeton, and it's like, we can't do it. You know, we have to have somebody say it for us.
You're right about Rolls, though, boy. Have you seen the new Ghost? Oh, man, that thing is just sweet.
And no letters, no numbers, just Ghost.
Yeah.
See?
Well, look at the 911 Carrera. Fabulous. You know.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Bentley. I always thought the Arnage was a great name.
Yeah, Arnage, Malsan.
Yeah.
For the
mm-hmm.
the main straight of
Le Mans. Although I'm surprised Ford didn't go sue them for using Continental. But they put the GT with
it. But Bentley had Continental in the 50s, too.
Yeah, but, you know, it all comes down to who's got what trademarked. And I'm sure they just had a gentleman's agreement that they would let
what
Bentley
about the Volt name? I've never been crazy about it. Now, I think the Opel is going to be called the Ampera, which I'm assuming comes from amperes. That's a really cool name. Volt is, I don't know.
Yeah, what do you think of Volt name?
I like Volt.
Yeah.
Volt works for me.
It's got that V, and,
right.
And boom.
Exactly.
Consonant.
Exactly. And it just kind of works for the car, the whole electrical. It speaks exactly to one of the key benefits. So I really, really like the name Volt. I'm just a fan of those short names. So, I think it's a good name.
Yeah.
Why don't you like it?
It just doesn't. I mean, this is a really high tech car, and Volt doesn't seem. It doesn't seem that sophisticated to me. It's sort of too simplistic for a car that's such a showcase of technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Prius is a pretty cool name,
right?
For that kind of car, and then they advertise it. Prius Genius is also some pretty damn good advertising.
Mm-hmm.
That really works. I don't think Volt's a terrible name. It's just.
I think they should call it the Kilo. In honor of Reddy Kilowatt.
Speaking of electrically charged names, I love Ford's name Home for their new system bringing together the hybrid cars, and they're teaming up with Microsoft to develop Home, and it's H-O-H-M.
Yeah.
I think that's so smart and forward-thinking, kind of getting at integrating your car into your home in this smart energy management. So I think that's a great name. Anytime you can get a play on words in successfully, I think that's clever.
Now, what about Ford and Mercury with the alliterative names, Ford Focus, Ford Fusion, Mercury Milan? You know, I'm waiting for the sports car called the Fang, you know. does that work?
Well, back when Chevy did the Camaro, to go back to that, that was when Chevrolet, all their names had to start with a C. All their
Chevelle and
car names, Chevelle, Corvette.
Well, Ford got into a thing there for a while where everything had to be with an F.
Right.
Right. And
still is, right?
And the Fiesta, yeah. Mm-hmm. So
Fiesta Focus, yeah, right.
Now, Taurus is not.
I mean, it represents, it's cool. It represents this kind of synergy in between the brands and kind of subtly alludes to where this common line of thought throughout all of the brands. But it's kind of has a limitation because what happens when you run out of Fs? And then the first one that isn't an F, what does that mean? And people are searching for the meaning. So it's fun and it's, you know, but it's not everlasting.
You should make a party van called the Fandango.
I like Bongo. Someone should bring that back.
Bongo van, yeah.
Then a competitor would have to bring out something called the Desi.
Hey, why don't we bring the audience in on this discussion? Ben, let's bring up the graphic for Rapid Fire. Okay, Mike Dwight obviously has seen that Chrysler is not showing us any of its future product right now or even any stuff coming out this year because he says, will Chrysler's secrecy about its upcoming products help or hurt its sales?
Well, I've been told they have a conscious decision to not hype their products too far in advance so that when it actually hits the showroom, it's old hat. But I think they have to show a couple of them pretty soon to start showing that they're relevant and they're still around. I mean, that doesn't mean you have to open the kimono on everything, but geez, they got to start showing us some stuff. And they've shown us the 300 Charger and Grand Cherokee on background, but they haven't shown them publicly. And they're launching pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's...
I don't know. Here's where I totally agree with what Chrysler's doing for this very moment, because as soon as people see that better stuff's coming, they're not going to buy what's in the showroom right now. And that Chrysler's got to sell what's there.
Cars that are like, you know, 4, 5, 6 months away.
I know. Then you kill their replacements or their the ones that they've got right now all that much sooner.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Well, they did announce they're going to replace the Sebring name with NASA.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that, Sebring versus NASA? Like NASA Bahamas.
I think it's fine. I mean, the place name thing is a trend for sure. For a while, there was the Wild West names.
Right. Every SUV was named after a place west of the Mississippi.
Right, which is supposed to make you think of foraging, you know, running over mountains and streams with your car, very manly, very pioneering.
No one took Dubuque.
Here. Okay, Scott Burgess. All right, Scotty's in the chat room here. Hey, we miss your burgers, man. Here we all sitting around starving. He was on the show earlier and he brought us.
He always brings a sack of burgers.
He says, can someone see if Nina can come up with more words like transition? You got any others?
Did you come up with Bridezilla?
Bridezilla, I didn't. I didn't come up with Bridezilla.
Okay, Pablo wants to know, can anyone tell me why it is that one cannot order a car the way they want it? Instead, you are subjected to buying packages that don't make any sense.
Well, that's the nature of the business. That's how they get those costs down to the, you know, the minute portions of pennies.
Well, it's also manufacturing simplicity.
Well, that's an
accommodation to the plan.
Yeah, explain that a little bit more, David, because that's a great point.
Well, I mean, the Japanese have done this for a long time. Honda and Toyota, they have like 3, maybe 4 trim levels, and it's just easier. You have this big module for every trim level that's got, you know, the satellite radio and navigation.
Also minimizes mistakes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Consistently.
Yeah. I hear people complain about this all the time. You know, they wanted the sunroof, but they didn't want the nav system. But, well, too bad you're stuck with it.
Yeah, and if you want heated seats, you got to get the cold climate group, and that's $1,800.
Right.
You
know. But Pablo does have a good point, because there are some options that are very, very popular that they really stick it to you if you want, and you got to get all this other crap that you don't want.
Well, let's set the Wayback Machine to the future when the whole industry revolves around China and India, and the domestic automobile industry will be relegated to a cottage industry. By then, Pablo, we can call up the factory, and you can go down and pick your Chevrolet just the way you want, because they only sell about 3 a month by that time.
What about the 5-day car? Remember that 10 years ago where you could custom order anything you wanted? You could ship them a sweater of yours, and they'd match the leather and the paint up to it and all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
It was all a big mirage. And now they've actually, you know, they've gone in this opposite direction where it's all...
Well, the problem is that the 5-day car or the 3-day car or even the 1-month car that they were shooting for at first was a manufacturing solution to a retail problem. And that's never going to work. You got to come up with a retail solution to a retail problem, not a manufacturing one. Anyway, Phil in Burlington Says, what are Nina's thoughts? He's kind of regurgitating what we already said, but he asks it something subtly different that I think is important. He says, what are Nina's thoughts on naming a car with letters and numbers like A4, Z3, MX5 versus giving a car a name like Mustang, Equinox, Park Avenue? Who does each appeal to and why?
I'm glad that he asked that question because I honestly think that there's kind of a gender differentiation there. I think that numbers and letters tend to resonate with males more often. There's, you know, for instance, if there's a 3 series and then a 5 series and then a 7 series, there's this built-in competition. So somebody that is driving the 3 series knows that there's the next step above, and there's this competitive kind of more testosterone-driven kind of vibe to that. Whereas if you have a name that makes a more emotional kind of personal connection, that will resonate with females much more often.
In other words, we're stupid and predictable.
Competitive, if nothing else.
I would have thought it was generational, where younger buyers like the alphanumerics and older buyers like Park Avenues and, you know,
is that
Seville's instead of STS's and stuff like that.
But then is that because everybody's jumping on the alphanumeric bandwagon no matter what industry you're in, so we're all just more used to that now kind of thing?
I thought it was because the luxury brands that went to the alphanumerics, you know, first BMW and Mercedes, were the hip brands at the time they switched to it, and the younger generations latched onto it. And the old buyers were driving Buick Park Avenues and Cadillac Eldorados and Lincoln Continentals, and they were the old farts. And they were, their kids were driving BMW 2002s and then later, you know, 318s and stuff like that. And then Mercedes did. And then, you know, Acura, you know, as if they, you know, because they wanted to make every possible mistake they could in the course of their history, replaced Legend, you know, with RL. And what was the other really? What was the midsize that had a great
Integra?
Name?
Integra.
Integra. It was a cool name. And
the Legend was brilliant. Yeah, and they walked away from one of the greatest names. Crazy.
Acura has been a reoccurring train wreck forever.
Right. The barriers are down and the gongs are dinging. Yeah. Hey, we got a phone call. Ben, let's bring in the phone call that we've got here.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan Brown out in Old Bend, Jersey. I have to tell you, last week's show with Doug Feehan was awesome.
Was.
He nailed it. I mean, it's all about performance, price, value, performance for and maintenance costs that are in line with normal human beings with any kind of sensibility towards logic. That's what the Corvette's about. I'm looking forward to the C7, just as Peter described, a couple hundred pounds less, if that, a little smaller, same power, maybe another 10%, and the DSG tranny. I mean, really, that's the things that people are looking for. Figure 50-50 split on present bed production, automatic and manual. Just put a DSG in, and I bet you you'll see automatic manual ratios go from 50-50 to probably 75-25 or 80-20 in favor of the automatic DSG with manual capability. Anyways, listen, love the show. Have to say I'm sorry I missed it. Of all the weeks for me to be out there making pizzas like David Welch always says, I missed the show, caught it on podcast. That was your best show yet, or at least one of the ones that I found the most interesting. Every one of them is interesting, but that was a really good one. So no more pizza making for me. David will have to order in.
Thanks, Jonathan. That guy's great. 007, Mitch W. says, what does Nina think about all the unfamiliar names being used in the information technology startup world? Names being used, I don't like the iPad.
Apple, you know, it makes me think similarly to the Ford Fiesta, Ford Focus. The eyes are going to run out someday. It's going to happen. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword because names like iPad, iPhone, it's strong now and it's strengthening the brand because each next product that comes out reinforces the last one, but it's not going to last. And it sets up this huge expectation of what the next step is going to be. So Does that answer his question?
Yeah. Or, you know, or what about using unfamiliar names?
Like Droid.
Well, Droid sort of fits
it's
in.
It's familiar, but and from what I'm reading about the phone, it's...
What about the phone called the Chocolate? I mean, that to me, I mean, it's...
Well, there's actually...
It's light years away from what the product actually is.
Right.
But it's kind of cool.
It is cool. There's a name continuum. So on one end, there are names that are descriptive. U.S. Steel, General Motors. There's no question about what they do. On the other end is the empty vessel name. When we were talking about the Venza, they did themselves a disservice to try to rationalize and explain what the name is, where if they left it as an empty vessel, just kind of like your reaction initially, I don't know, it just kind of sounds good. Nobody had a really negative connotation.
I love that. Empty vessel.
And then in the middle are the suggestive names. So they don't directly speak to a benefit. You can't eat the phone. But chocolate has, you know, these...
Everybody loves chocolate. Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just generally broadly positive. The phone that came out this week, or very recently, was the Incredible. The Droid Incredible, which was...
I was just reading about that today.
Yeah, and...
And it is incredible.
That's what I hear.
And it's better than the iPhone, and it's incredible, but... really?
Yeah.
You could name it Incredible.
It's a very ballsy move, but yeah. It's kind of like what you were saying with the taglines before in the automotive industry, where if you have a tagline that really sets the bar high, if you have a name that really sets the bar high... It's that fulfilling, self-fulfilling prophecy. You're going to get there. It's your promise to yourself and your consumers. So I love the name Incredible.
Jay Cujo wants to know, why are the big three so afraid of heritage names? Case in point, Cadillac and Lincoln. Unless you're a car guy, you have no idea what an MKT or an ATS is, but instantly know what a Continental or an Eldorado are.
That's part of the problem, though, because...
Is that generational?
Well, I'm just saying for... You know, a lot of these names, like, you know, that I grew up with, a lot of these were bad cars.
But people don't remember now.
I think they remember the bad cars from the 80s and up until, what, about the late 90s, some of them still had quality issues. I mean, you know, they've debated hotly when they replaced Grand Am with G6. And Malibu, they talked about quite a bit. They got rid of Cavalier for Cobalt. You know, the car isn't that great, but...
How'd that work out for Pontiac? Not so much.
I remember someone at Pontiac, actually, was it Wynn Myers? Was she the one who ran Pontiac back then?
Yeah, maybe.
She asked me and some other journalists, should we change the name to G6? And I said, you know, G6 is a pretty cool name. But you got to be honest with yourself. If the new car is truly breakthrough, then it's worth it to spend the money to build, you know, brand name recognition for this all-new name. But if it's just a slight improvement on the current car, which is, you know, a lagger in the segment, don't waste your time.
G6 sounds like a, you know, a spy organization.
Yeah, but then they had G8, you know, it was a bit of a
so
family.
The thing about the alphanumerics is that within the context of the brand, it can be helpful of differentiating one to the other. But when you take it to a greater context, that's where it loses its meaning for me personally. And, in branding and in marketing and in advertising, context is everything. You have to, any new message that you put out has to be put out, not just because you think it sounds good or you think it sounds good in the boardroom, but you have to be all ears and all eyes, just completely aware of whatever else is going on. So if other people are using the numbers, then your alphanumeric name will inevitably be mixed up with some other brand that's using the alphanumeric system also.
I totally agree. I get confused about it. You know, and we study this stuff every day at work, and
well,
I get
Mercedes
confused about
has
it.
So many nameplates now. I lose track of, you know.
What's what?
CLKs and, you know, all these different
you bet.
Names they've got, yeah.
Todd Cruz from Decatur, Illinois, sent us almost a letter here, and so I'm going to paraphrase it. And Peter, I'll throw this to you. What do you guys think of Alpha's possibilities in the United States?
Well, we came up last week.
Yeah, we touched upon it last week. I mean, I'm an Alpha fan, but amongst all the other things Sergio's going to be doing, he's going to relaunch Alfa Romeo in the United States. That would take... Oh, I don't know, $200 million all by itself?
In ad dollars.
In ad dollars, and that's just the first initial blip. So this
will come out of Fiat's, or you know, Alfa's budget, the company in Italy.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
Chrysler.
I'm all for Alfas in the U.S., but it sounds too grandiose, too overreaching, too overwrought. I mean, you know, bring one good Alfa. I don't need instantly six Alfas for sale in the U.S. The American consumer is going to go, what? I mean, it's just.
If they sold them in Chrysler showrooms, they might generate a lot of traffic to those Chrysler showrooms.
You know, but I think, Peter, I think you're onto something. Bring one over. Stick your toe in the water.
Bring one great Alfa over.
Right.
Reestablish a beachhead in the U.S. in the consumers' minds. Because right now, all they have is the Graduate.
Yeah.
You know, which was cool. I mean, that was a great sports car, but I mean, it's been a while.
Okay, we got a question from Jim. Question for Nina. He says, seeing as you worked with Kia, did you pick the names of the puppets in the Kia ads?
No, I didn't.
Although but you did work with Kia naming products, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's why you like the Soul.
I didn't work on the Soul name, but Kia, and then also worked on naming the Mercedes-Benz telematics system, too. So
which Kia names did you work on?
It was the Sorento, the Rondo, and the Picanto at the former naming agency that I was with before the naming group. So that kind of, all of those names have a hard O ending, which we would then call kind of a nomenclature system where they reinforce one another. And it's that O ending is hard and masculine and also just, it's a hard stop. So it's Picanto, Rondo, Sorento.
Okay, George from Brooklyn wants to know, how do bad sales or consumer feedback influence the naming of cars?
Well, kind of like what you were saying before, where with the shifts that Lincoln is going through, and, you know, people will start to associate negative things with the name, and that's why they'll go and opt for this change. Sometimes it just seems unnecessary. Sometimes it seems like they just want to change the name just to refresh it for the sake of refreshing it. And mm-hmm. I think that you're right, that in order for there to be reason for there to be a change, it has to be warranted. So in answer to that question, if there are problems that are going to be associated with that name and only that name, it's not, you know, Toyota, for instance, now is having its fair problems, but it's not associated with just one. Kind of, it's not just associated with one name. So, but if it were, then you would be best off to change that name. It'll be tainted forever.
Okay, and we'll make this the last one. For Peter, if GM created the best marketing project possible and spent consistently enough to support it, how long would it take to reach maximum share and profit?
36 months.
Wow. 3 years. Doing everything perfect.
Doing everything perfect.
Why does it take so long? Is that's what it takes to drive a message into the head of the average consumer?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, we live in a nanosecond culture. I mean, the attention span is so fleeting anymore that you just have to keep pounding away consistently, day in, day out, before it starts to sink in. And yeah, you know, if they brought me on board and they said, well, how long is this going to take? Ed, big Ed, Peter, how long is this going to take? I said, 36 months, Ed. I'm going to tell you right now, no instant miracles here. But
it's an interesting thing you bring up because our attention spans are a lot shorter. But then on the other hand, there's so much more opportunity for engagement.
Absolutely.
It's not about marketing. It's not about a 30 or 60 second ad.
No.
You can go take a crap during an ad, but you come back, you know, if something is continually in your life, if it's a Facebook app, if it's on the subway as you're going by.
It's everything all the time, just like you say. But it would take 3 years.
Wow.
Really.
So, interesting.
You're talking just to get the name recognition out there and really
just to sort of just align GM marketing with the level of their products, because their level of their products keep going up. The marketing isn't there yet. It's going to take that long to link them up.
Yeah, because and there's the practical side of it is you build the marketing as the new models come out. And, you know, you may have good overarching brand messaging from the master brand, but, you know, as the new ATS and XTS come out, say, for Cadillac, you know, those are a couple, 3 years away. And, you know, that reinforces the brand, and so does the advertising for those cars.
Yeah, so, if I was Cadillac right now, I'd go right with Standard of the World and say, get everybody together in one room and say, everything we do has to live up to this tagline from here on out.
I still don't think they're ready. I think they need to maybe do that, something like that, with the launch of the XTS.
Well, see, they're never going to be ready, though. See, you're never going to be ready for that.
You got to put the flag in the ground now and say everybody works to this.
But I think people are going to walk in the showroom. They're going to see a really cool CTS, a really nice SRX, and everything else in there is either, you know, long in the tooth or irrelevant. And they're going to say, this isn't the standard of the world. This isn't even the standard of the gold mile of dealerships on this road.
Well, but you just mentioned two vehicles that are quite good. And you're just going to have to focus, put the good stuff in front. And
well, you know, everything that they've got right now is going to change very quickly, because the DTS and the STS go away very quickly and get replaced by the ATX, right?
XTS.
See, there we go. There we go.
Good point.
And then the only
2012.
Yeah. Okay. So one or 2 years.
The ATS, the small one, is
right.
No, that's 2 years, and then three for the other stuff.
Well, Peter's saying 36 months to get everything aligned. Just.
I know, but
from a marketing standpoint,
tomorrow go to Standard of the World, and then these standard-bearing cars don't actually show up in the showroom for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, but how?
I mean,
what happens?
You guys think that
now what happens is where is that? Where do consumers see Standard of the World, and what do they associate with?
Well,
you can orchestrate that.
There's a difference between marketing and branding. You know, there's marketing, which is much more about getting the benefits of those specific products out to people. But if your brand message, the basis of what everything that your company is, isn't solidified and isn't strong and isn't elevated, like this tagline, all that stands for, then it doesn't matter when the product comes out or what it is, because when you have established your brand, you know, through the very bottom building block, then everything else will catch up and those gaps will close. But
yeah, but this is a company whose credibility has been damaged by years of bad quality, horrendous financial results, eventual bankruptcy, and a government bailout. So
I'm with
to say I'm the standard of the world, and you have two cool cars in the showroom.
I'm with you, David. But you cannot base your decisions on that logic when it comes to this. You have to put your
you
flag
to that
in the ground.
Internal meetings and say this is where we're headed.
No, yeah, I mean, you have to put your flag in the ground, and you're going to just have to go, and you're going to have to take the slings and arrows that are going to come, but then you're going to have to deliver on the other end. And if you deliver, consumers will start. That's why it's at 36 months. They'll start to say, oh, okay, well, there's something going on there.
Well, and it's the taglines like moving forward is Toyota or working harder. Frankly, as a consumer, I want to hear a little bit more than that. I want to hear that this is my promise to you and this is what I'm going to bring forth, not just we're working on it. You can communicate continual change and you don't have to be too overconfident, but if you, you know, as you said, put the flag in the ground and set it, then I think it inspires confidence in people.
This is where Cadillac should go back and study its history, because if you go back to the late 20s when Cadillac decided it wanted to become the luxury brand, which it was not at the time, Packard was the standard in the United States. And
that's when Cadillac started building 12s and 16s.
Exactly right. And Sloan made the commitment, we're going to fund this for the next 20 years, because he said from the beginning it's going to take 20 years to do this.
Yeah, it'll take 36 months for GM to even get to where you start, and then from there you go on.
Right.
But Sloan was right. Yeah, it takes 20 years. Ultimate driving machine, 20 years.
Right.
But one of the big things for Cadillac back then, and I'm not going to get the years exactly right, but in like 1912 or 13, Henry Leland won the award for being able to make.
Oh, much earlier than that. It was like
maybe 1908 or 1909
something like
or something.
That, right, yeah.
He worked at the Springfield Armory, so he understood precision machining. Interchangeable parts. And so Cadillacs, until really Harley Earl showed up, were known as very well-engineered, nice, but kind of boring cars. They were like the Lexus of their day. But because they were the first with interchangeable parts and they were very precisely made, and I think they were very good quality, they could say they were the standard of the world because when it came to that engineered stuff, they were. And you could plant that flag. I mean, Cadillac's quality is pretty good right now, but they're still, they don't get the Consumer Reports recommendation. I mean, they're just, they're so early in the game of coming back, even though, you know, I think the two cars that they have that are selling well are really great cars. But mm-hmm. So I'm in the minority here. That's fine.
Yeah, but you got the cover story on that.
I'll take the flings and arrows tonight.
Right. Hey, we ought to wrap it up here. But, Peter, great having you. David, as always, terrific having you here. And Nina, it's been delightful, really. I mean, it's really cool talking about all these names and everything that goes into it. So much more of a science than just flipping a coin.
You got it.
Hey, remember, you can always follow us at facebook.com/AutoLineDetroit or twitter.com/AutoLine. Can follow Peter at autoextremist.com every week, also twitter.com/autoextremist. Follow David's work. Go to businessweek.com right now. The story just broke this evening. And Nina, I understand we can follow you at twitter.com/NinaBeckhart. Mm-hmm. And also the naming group is the name of your company, The Naming Group.
You
so
got
you're
it.
At... thenaminggroup.com, right?
And you can also follow us on Twitter, /thenaminggroup.
Okay, great. And remember, you can follow us on Stitcher, listen to us on your BlackBerry or smartphone, and thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
Visit our website, autolinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutoLineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.